Okay, we're on.
Yeah, right, okay. You can all hear me, just double check that, please.
Sorry.
I've unmuted, okay, yeah? Take that to be a yes. Okay, welcome again, welcome back, or however many times you've been, to this extraordinary venture through parts of Genesis to see what we find in it that's really strange. I'm going to take a little detour in a minute, actually, out of our normal chapters, just to show you something else. But I was thinking again, I do think between these meetings, you know, I do have another think about some of the passages. And I was thinking again about those trees and what was really sort of going on there a little bit, this tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I had two extra sort of thoughts on it, that by taking of that tree, it's given us the desire to experience what we already know is wrong. We suddenly want to not just know what's wrong, but we have a desire to experience it for ourselves. It's not enough just to be told. We've really got to, we want to experience it. That's part of our nature now. And you see that very prevalent in many people. And also out of that comes what people often express as, well, nobody's telling me what to do. And that may be the way some people live entirely, or it might be a bit more sort of subconscious or unspoken with some people. But there's this real desire within us that no one's really going to tell me what to do. And that made me think about Jesus, who said something like, I'm only going to do what the Father shows me or tells me. And that's the contrast between his nature and ours. Who's telling us what to do? And quite often it's me, wants to tell me what to do. So that came out of my thinking about the chapter in Genesis 3, which we've looked at. I also mentioned this word where. The question where are you, is not about location. It's about where have you gone? Why aren't you here? It's a particular use of the word. And I began to think then about the word here. So I'm going to take you just a couple of minutes to Genesis 22. Again, we could look at this in more detail later. It's a very familiar one, but it's another weird one, with God actually requiring Abraham to, well, at least go a long way towards sacrificing his son, which, of course, he would have known that was part of his old culture in Mesopotamia, where they did that sort of thing. So now he's discovering that this God, the God he now is worshipping and following, may have said that, but he didn't intend it. So that's a big difference. But the word here, behold, here I am. It starts off with God saying to Abraham, well, he calls his name Abraham, calls it out, Abraham. And Abraham's response is this rather interesting word, which is translated as, behold, here I am. And again, it's not as though Abraham is having to tell God where he is, as though God somehow doesn't know where he is. By saying, here I am, and he's saying, I'm available, I'm with you. Just like the where have you gone is, why aren't you with me? He's actually saying, yeah, I'm with you at this point. And one of the things we look for in these stories is where words like this repeat, particularly if it's at the beginning, you get it again at the end. And I'm sure you know that at the end of, well, not the very end of the story, but the last bit of the sacrifice bit, the angel of the Lord calls to him from heaven, and this time says his name twice. And again, he says, Hineni, here I am. In fact, in the first verse, it was, here I am, this is here am I. Okay, it doesn't matter, it's the same word. You can twist it around a little bit. But again, it's not just, oh yeah, you found me, here I am. It's, I am here listening with you, and so on. Now, what you may not have in your Bible, depending how it's been translated, is in verse 7 of that chapter, which is actually the emotional heart of this, really, although there's a lot of emotions in it. But at one point, Isaac speaks to Abraham, his father, and says, my father. this is the verse 7. Can you see how many of these vayomers are there? He said, and so on. So, and said Isaac to Abraham, his father, he said, my father, and then said, and Abraham actually says to him, Hineni. He says the same word as he said twice, or he's going to say twice, said once and will say again to God. And my English version just has something like, yes, my son, which is very sort of cold and sort of, Isaac is suddenly saying, father, and he says, yes, son. He's not. He's actually saying, I'm here to his son. He's actually saying, I'm right here. He's almost saying, I'm not going anywhere. I'm with you. I'm walking with you. I'm going on this journey with you. And this is the moment, I think, which Abraham probably dreaded. Because they're walking along and nobody's really saying anything. But sooner or later, he knows Isaac is going to have to say something. Because sooner or later, he will work out something's not quite right. And of course, he's going to say, where is the lamb? And I think that must be the where word. Not where has the lamb gone? Not that we've got a lamb here. Oh, where's he hiding? Where's he trotted off to? It's, why is it not here? Why is there no lamb here? Why haven't we brought one? How come we're going all this way with all this stuff and there's no lamb? And you can almost imagine sooner or later, Abraham thinking sooner or later, Isaac's going to ask that. And he's going to need a lot of reassuring at this point. So when Isaac actually speaks to or suddenly says something to Abraham and says, my father, Abraham starts off with not just a sort of, oh yes, what do you want? But I'm here, I'm with you. Whatever's now going through your mind, I'm with you. Now, the story then develops from there, as we know. But I thought it's interesting that you've got this word Hineni occurring at the beginning and the end and here in the middle as a sort of framework for this particular story. Three times there is the here, meaning not just a geographical thing, but I'm right with you, I'm on your side, I'm available, I'm not going anywhere, sort of here. Okay, so that's just some preliminary thoughts. We can open it up for some comments or questions on that before we get back into our main studies on things. If anyone wants to raise a hand or make a comment of any kind on this chapter, or anything I've said so far, or just that's on your mind.
Yeah, just the question of, for me, it's just the question of intent. So with obedience, it's I think intent is important. So sometimes we may not obey where we are not quite certain of what it is we're meant to be doing. For example, if something is vague, then we may not obey, and those that are more knowledgeable may see it as a willfulness to be disobedient, whereas perhaps for someone that is less knowledgeable, maybe it's not, the intention is not to be willfully disobedient, I would say.
Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking of something else now, but while I find it, has anyone else got a comment?
Yeah, Pat, Scottish Pat.
It's just that just after this incident, Isaac goes away. He doesn't actually return with his father. So does this have an impact on what he actually does next?
Oh, I say, maybe. I haven't thought that far ahead. That's an interesting point. So do you mean in the next chapter, in the what follows?
It's almost, I'm doing this from memory. Isn't it almost immediately after this, after the sacrifice, when they killed the ram and things, and I think after that he goes his own way, I think.
Okay. Well, maybe if we look at other parts of Genesis another time, that sort of thing will come up, because, as I said, there's lots more interesting things in these later chapters. And we've got another hand at the moment.
Yes, Mary.
Yeah, just following on from what Pat said, that he didn't come down, didn't go back with his father. I read a teaching on that, and it said that once the sacrifice was over and the ram given, you don't hear of Isaac again until he goes for his bride, until his bride comes to him. So it's almost like Jesus, when he died, really, we're not going to see him now until he comes for his bride.
Yeah.
Or until Jesus. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting. The other thing I just thought of is that here in, which is Isaiah 6, Isaiah uses the same word when the voice of the Lord says, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for me? Here am I, send me." He says the same word, "Hineni," here I am. Again, obedience, willingness, availability, not just here, I'm standing here, but I'm going to do what you want, and so on. Okay, I thought that was an introduction. What I thought we'd do now from the Genesis point of view is we go backwards before we go forwards. And then we'd look now at chapters 2 and 3 and 4. I think that was as far as we got. We might have dipped ahead a little bit. But what we haven't done is actually look at Genesis chapter 1, the sort of first creation account. And there's a very good reason for not doing that very much. It's because I don't think, personally, there's anything weird in these opening verses in chapter 1 into chapter 2. Nothing weird at all in that particular chapter. So that's done. Unless, of course, you think otherwise. I've got some interesting things to say on it, but I find it very, very straightforward, to be honest. I don't find it as weird as some of the other things, provided you read it as it was intended and not as we might otherwise want it to be. And I think the problems with this chapter comes when people think it's there for a different reason from what it is. And it might be fairly obvious to say this, but of course, God didn't give us Genesis chapter 1 in order to have some kind of weapon against evolution, as though somehow several thousands of years later, we would need this in order to counter what modern people are saying. So I don't think we should even think about using it in that sort of way. We've got to take it for what it is, which is concise, majestic, very sparse in its details, and very poetic. And if we read it as a wonderful piece of expressive Hebrew, then a lot of the unnecessary questions that we might be tempted to ask, we might actually not want to ask them anymore and just accept it for what it is. But before I keep on saying a few more thoughts as to why I find this a straightforward sort of story compared to the others, do you want to say, but I find that weird, or I wonder what's going on here, or whatever. So do you want to make some comments or thoughts on that now, before I say one or two other things?
Okay, Mary, you need to unmute yourself.
Well, my thoughts were on when God was creating all the various things. In verse 8 of chapter 1, he didn't call it good.
Oh, okay.
And he called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day, and there was no sign of it being good.
Oh, right. That's interesting. Okay. Does it not come up later in that same day, or is it sort of, is it included later on, is what I'm asking?
Oh, I see. right, well, yeah, in verse 10 it says, "And God saw that it was good."
Yes, but that, so maybe, but that's now in the next day, isn't it? So,
yeah, no, so it wasn't good on the second day.
Yes, not that it was bad. It just means
no. It didn't.
Yes. Okay. I get you. Yeah. Okay. This word "good" itself is interesting because it will be, I'm fairly sure, the word "tov." Tov, meaning good. But what does it actually mean, do you think? What was God actually saying when he did see that it was good? How do you understand that word? Anyone?
Pleasing to him?
Yes, I think it certainly relates to him. Pleasing is one aspect of it, yeah. Anything else?
I was just going to say that it was the way that he wanted it to be.
Yes, absolutely. And therefore, it doesn't have to be perfect in anything other than it was just right. Okay? He had actually done what he set out to do. Whatever that was. It was enough. So each time you get that phrase, it's as though God suddenly thinks, right, satisfied, that's done, move on. And of course, we know at the end it was also very good. But part of this, understanding this way in which it's expressed, is that God seems to know when it's time to stop the thing he's currently doing and move on to the next thing. Now, I'm not talking about any kind of chronology here, but I'm talking about within the creative process, and because we've been created in such a way that we can understand that, because as bearers of his image, we can do some of these things to a lesser extent. Whenever we are creating something, one of our problems is knowing, well, I've actually finished it. Is that done? Should I stop now? Because sometimes you go on too much, too far, and it's gone past its good and it's become less good because we've said too much, written too much or whatever. So God knew when to move on, if you like, on that.
Elaine had a hand up a minute ago.
Yeah. Anything else on that?
Well, actually, what I was going to say has already been said. So
right.
No worries. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments before I... Otherwise, I'll just keep going and you fit in around me. So here's some of the questions that it's best not to ask. Because you're not told. So please don't ask me, when did this all happen? How long ago was all this? All I'm going to say is, I don't know, it's just in the beginning. And I'm going to have to leave it at that. This wonderful word, the opening word, Bereshit, if you know a bit of Hebrew, you might recognize the Resh bit. Resh as in Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, the beginning of the year. That's all we're told. So when did it all happen? It happened in the beginning. How long ago was that? Don't know. Not interested. If God hasn't told me something, if it's not there, I'm not too bothered about it. I'm going to just accept what's there and move on. Okay?
Mary had a hand up. Do you want to unmute?
Yeah, you were talking about Tov a few sentences ago. And I've got a wee note to myself in the Bible here, and it says, Tov, that which supports life. And that's what it says. Oh,
okay.
And I was told that by somebody from Israel.
Oh, right, okay. Well, let's accept that then. That's good. Thank you.
So Tov, it's good because it supports life. That which supports life.
Okay. Well, while I'm here in this verse, I love verse 3. It's so brilliant. In Hebrew, it's as brilliant, better than even in English. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. So here's the famous Vayomer Elohim, and God said, we're going to get that all the time. And then he says, Yechior, and Or is the word for light. And can you see that in the Yehi, you've got something that's going to become very familiar later on as part of Yahweh, in other words, his name, which is the I am, or the I will be, or the I always have been. This is part of the verb to be. So you've got Yehi Or, And then it just repeats Yahior, and that's just and. So the best way in Hebrew of thinking of it, even though in English it doesn't sound quite so good, but in Hebrew it's, and God said, light be, and light be. We have to turn the verb around a little bit and say there was light. But in Hebrew, it's just God saying, light be, and light be. That's the way it's expressed, which is very poetic, very dramatic almost. And that's all that seems to happen there, pretty much.
Is it that way? One new man.
Things going, so...
It might be worth mentioning that on day three is the traditional day for Jewish weddings, because God said, and it was good twice.
Yes. Okay.
So they reckon that there's a double blessing.
You're right. And that day, it's the equivalent of our Tuesday, which might seem strange to us, but you're right. So yes, on day three. Yeah, thank you. I'd forgotten that from. These days, I hope these days don't bother you. It's part of the poetry of it. To me, that's the way we're meant to read and understand it, rather than make anything more on it. How long are these particular days? I haven't got a clue. God hasn't told me. It's just their days here. So as far as I'm concerned, you can believe anything you like about that. But whatever you do believe... you can't insist upon others believing the same thing, because it's not fixed in scripture. It's just, this is the way it's expressed. But at least you won't find me arguing about it. I'm not even going to say that each of these days was the same length. Certainly some things seem to have, some days seem to have more things happening in them. And when we looked last time, or was it the time before, into chapter 2, what we read in chapter 2 must have happened within the equivalent of day 6 within chapter 1, all the naming of the animals and everything. If you're going to fit that into the framework of this, which is a wonderful sort of poem, then that makes that day very long indeed. So the days are there to give us a framework. You've got this refrain about there was evening and there was morning, and what God did. And the way the structure works, you may know this already, but God spends 3 days separating and then 3 days filling. So he's creating environments to start with, habitations, and then he's filling it, or indeed, I've heard it expressed as he's fattening it out then, or filling it out with the inhabitants of it, and so on. So the structure of the poem is to take us through a process to understand that God separated in order to create these environments, and then he filled them, which is why you don't get the lights until day 4 within the structure of the poem. We've already got light, whatever that is, the initial energy, the initial spectrum of things. And later on, we've got the great lights, because we don't need those until God is beginning to fill up what he has actually established as the environments for it.
Yeah. Paul, there's an interesting note in One New Man Bible about the light before the sun and the moon. And it says the light was the aura of God until he created the sun.
Yeah, a sort of supernatural light, a sort of non-physical light. I think that's the way in which you can, because it's poetry, because it's Hebrew, if you can find extra things like that, that's fine. But I don't have a problem with this being the initial explosion of energy from which everything else was eventually going to be formed. So again, there's some, because this is such, all the words that are used are so simple, the structure is so basic, it's really there to contrast with all the other creation stories that, like I keep saying, Abraham will have known from his time in Mesopotamia, these great long epics and sagas with lots of different gods creating different bits and fighting it out and so on. This is just a wonderful, oh, at last we've got something simple and basic to help us worship God rather than to wade through a whole lot of stories that, well, just don't make any sense really, but other cultures have developed. another interesting thing is, suppose you are Abraham, or you are the Israelites, or even later on, around the time of the disciples and so on, do you think people's view of the earth was that it was flat? Were they all flat earthers at this time? And did they believe from their primitive cosmology that the heavens were like domes, concentric domes, like first, second, third, fourth, fifth heaven? And then underneath the flat earth, that's where the underworld was. Did they, you think, have that kind of cosmology? Because you can have that kind of cosmology and still understand all this. And later, when we realize that it wasn't like the early people believed, you can still read all this and accept it. We've got a couple of hands up, I think.
Yes, Mary first and then Rosalind.
Oh, there's a verse, I think it's Isaiah, but I'm not sure, where it says, and the Lord sits above the circle of the earth.
Yeah.
No, I don't know, but maybe you know where it is. But
no, not off the top of my head, but I think I'm familiar with it. And yes, is that suggesting something? I mean, people would originally have thought the earth was flat. They would have no reason. And also to think that everything went round when eventually they saw the sun and the moon moving, things went round the earth. There's no problem with that. That's just how it appeared to them at the time. And there's nothing here to go with it or against it. Someone says that there's a lot of ambiguity left in this, so that anybody at any time could read this and understand what God was saying. And one of the best descriptions I've heard of the whole sort of, oh, how long did this take and what were the 6 days and all the rest of it, was when a young girl read it and said, oh, so no sooner said than done then. That didn't take long, did it? And when we read it like this, it doesn't take long, because God just speaks. He just says something and it happens. No sooner said than done. I think it's a wonderful way of getting into the poetic feel of all this.
Yes, Rosalind has something to say. You need to unmute yourself.
All right. Yes, all that I was going to say was that I wondered whether they had any concept of how the world was at all, which I'm sure is wrong. And I'm sure that, as you say, Paul, they probably thought that it was flat. But all I was going to say was that I wondered whether they were aware even of how the world was.
Well, yes, because I had a thought some time back, that when it talks about him separating the land from the waters, I wonder how much of the seas and the oceans they actually realised at that point. they must have seen bits of it and so on, but they wouldn't have known even. Of course, this is still pre-flood, and everything is going to change again after the flood. So we can't always compare our world with the world that they had before then. So, but eventually they would have realized, oh yes, there are seas and there are oceans, and all this would still make sense. They wouldn't have to keep rethinking, that was a sort of earlier version of creation, now we understand it better. All this still makes sense. And we got another hand.
Yes, Elaine.
Yes, in verse that says about he made the stars. Sorry if this sounds a really silly question, but I take it by that is inclusive of the planets.
Well, why not?
And how extensive, what sort of awareness of how extensive the universe was?
Yes. But they see all they would see for centuries and centuries and centuries would be the sun, the moon, and lots of other lights in the sky. We didn't discover planets for quite a long time, really. in human history. So they wouldn't be aware of a solar system, but they would be aware that there were other lights in the sky. So it's a lovely little phrase, and God made the stars also. There's billions of them, we know now, trillions of them. But that's just sort of tossed out there as an extra little thing that he did on that part of the day. So,
okay, Val has a question.
I'm wondering why they would even think about whether the Earth was round or whether it was flat.
Yeah.
I mean, as a child growing up, my parents weren't believers, but they knew that there was a God out there, a creator out there. And I just accepted it, wouldn't they? Just accept things. Why does one always have to, go to the ultimate conclusion? Is the Earth flat or is it round? What does it matter?
Well, what you're saying is, would that question have ever occurred to them?
Yeah.
In those terms, and yes, you're probably right. Probably right. Because if you're not travelling very far, you're not going to think in those terms, really. So, yeah, good point. Good point. I'll tell you this, a little sort of a personal anecdote from when I was in my pushchair. My mum always used to explain this, but I think I was about that age. I don't know for sure, but I was very young. But I suddenly asked the question about the moon. Is the moon round like a plate or is it round like a ball?
Ah.
And that was the beginning of my mathematical journey into geometry and things like that. And I think
interesting. Went,
what on earth is this three-year-old or something asking a question like that for? But I was curious at that point. Is the moon round like a plate or round like a ball? So.
Well, obviously I had a very simple mind for
What I thought we would do to round this section off, unless you've got other questions or thoughts, but say again, my point was, I don't find this too weird, as long as I don't try and ask it the wrong questions. I just accept what I'm being told in poetic form, and then I can worship God out of it. I can come to this wonderful statement of who God is. But you know that, I'll say, as well, you know, it says in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that sort of phrase I mentioned before is a way of saying everything. If you take the two sort of extremes, heavens and the earth, that includes everything. And I said that about the phrase, the knowledge of good and evil, can mean the whole range of everything that's from one extreme of goodness to one extreme of evil. Like if you say you're searching high and low, you mean you're searching everywhere, not just up there and down here. So it's a way of saying in the beginning, God created absolutely everything. And then when it comes to an end, in chapter 2 and verse 4, it says the same thing, the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. So it's rounding off this whole first section, which as we know goes into chapter 2. And then when chapter 2 really gets going, if you like, from verse 4 onwards, then we get the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, which is the same thing, same phrase, but now the emphasis has switched onto the earth, because everything we read about in chapter 2 is what God was doing on earth, whereas in chapter 1 it's almost like a heavenly view, it's a different view, it's God's perspective. This was God's working week, and because it was all Tov, good, just right, just enough, he didn't have to go back to work after his day off. I'm not going to go into the Sabbath bit again. I've taught on that endlessly before. But as we know, God didn't have a day off because he was tired. I mean, he's hardly done anything, really. He'd just spoken a few times and then it all happened. Sorry, I don't mean to be flippant about it. But he didn't have a day off because he was tired. He had a day off because it was done. Because it was at that point sufficient for what he required.
Okay, but, Rosalind has a hand up.
Yeah.
You need to unmute, Rosalind.
Yeah, sorry, my question was just in relation to what you said at the beginning of the session, where you said that because of, you know, our fallen state, that we gravitate to wanting to do evil and not just to know about it.
Yeah.
But I wonder, even before we are saved, we still have an aversion to certain things. So yes, we'll always be in a fallen state. Yes, we'll always sin, but it's not, maybe this is not what you meant anyway, but we certainly don't want to try out all sorts of sins, do we? I mean, we...
No, and the things within us, we still have a conscience, we still have something of the image of God. But we know that people do want to do that. Even as Christians, I mean, if you think about Paul in Romans 7, which is quite a tough passage to get onto, but Paul is still saying, I'm battling the things that I
don't do,
and so on. Absolutely. So,
thank you.
It was all part of that. I was going to suggest we pause for 5 minutes, and I'm going to get you to read about the creation from elsewhere in the Bible, just in case you weren't familiar with the fact that you can read the creation story in two other places. One is a psalm, and the other is in Proverbs. So let me find them, and then I'll tell you. Where's Proverbs gone? In Proverbs 8, this is the shorter bit, but it's worth starting with this. This really is to do with wisdom, and it's to do with wisdom always being there and wisdom being around at the creation of the world. And we now think of that as being the Logos and Jesus and so on. But why don't you, first of all, read Proverbs 8 from 22 to 31. Proverbs 8, 22 to 31. Bearing in mind that the me and the I is actually wisdom. So that's giving that a little bit of it. But Psalm 104, which will take you a little longer because it's quite a long psalm, it's the same creation story. I'm sure you'll pick up the same sort of features of it, but this of course isn't set out in day one, day two, day three and so on, but it does seem to follow the same sort of pattern on that. So we'll pause for now, 5 minutes. So have a read of Proverbs 8, 22 to 31, and then Psalm 104. We'll have some comments on it afterwards if you wish, and then we'll move to a different part of Genesis as well. So I'm going to mute myself now as well and stop sharing, I think. See you in 5 minutes.
Proverbs 22, only got to verse 29.
Sorry, I forgot, I was muted. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 22 to 31. Well, I'm back with you now, but do... keep reading on for a minute or two if you need to. It's interesting that in both those passages, obviously particularly the psalm, it's all poetry again. It's all being expressed in poetic form, as though this is the best way to think about this. I love the way science sometimes tells me extra details about it, but this is the basis of what I believe, understand, and I'm very sorry for people who don't believe in creation, that they can't see the splendor and wonder of all this. There's some glorious phrases in all this. I love the bit about the Leviathan that was formed to frolic in the oceans, the sea vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number. And may the Lord rejoice in his works. So I hope that in our private devotions, meditations, and so on, we spend as much time thinking about creation, praising God for what he's done, rejoicing in it, than we do on other aspects of salvation and who God is and so on. It's absolutely key.
Am I able to say something now?
Yes, please. Let's have any comments if anyone has got anything on what they've read.
Yeah, all I was going to say was yes, how fortunate we are that when we see how perfect the Lord's provision is, that how could you not praise him for who he is, for what he's done, and how sad it is that until we see that, or for some people that never do,
yes,
you know, it's sort of how could they not, you know, sort of
yes,
see him for who he is. That's all. Yeah, just in agreement with what you said,
and,
really.
And I would add that we've got nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed about because we believe it's like this. Nothing at all.
Elaine has a hand up.
No, just saying, and nor should we think, oh no, there's a battle on all this. I'm not going to engage in a battle. I think evolution will eventually self-destruct somehow. It's already beginning to crack and crumble in places anyway. But if people don't want to believe in God as creator, then they'll find another thing to believe in instead. But we don't have to be embarrassed or bothered by the fact that we do. So, yeah, another comment perhaps?
Yes, Elaine.
Yes, thank you. So in Proverbs, certainly in the Proverbs passage,
yeah,
certainly in the first few verses, it's almost like there's a, to me, it came across as sort of a repetition of God providing the environment and then the whole thing of God filling it.
Yeah.
And also, interestingly, in terms of humans and creatures, there's only just the one mention of it, sort of in one sentence at the very end. Whereas in the Psalm 104, there's a lot of specific mention, you know, of specific animals and creatures.
Yeah.
And to the extent in which, you know, these creatures, and including, because it mentions mean in verse 23, I've got the message with me tonight. So it's saying, meanwhile, men and women go out to work. But interestingly, in the Genesis, of course, work, well, in the passages we've seen, work's not mentioned yet.
Yeah.
So I've just sort of like,
yeah, that's right. The same
things
ingredients
that stuck
are there
out to me.
Yeah, the same ingredients are there, but just expressed slightly differently.
Yes.
It is like sort of a later reflection on these things, because Genesis 1 is meant to be very basic and very, very simple almost, so that anybody at any time from any culture could read that and understand something about God. And that was its intention. So I like the way in the Proverbs 1, you've almost got this second person involved in creation, this person called wisdom, because wisdom is being personified in some of these passages. So it's almost like before God really got going, he had to create wisdom, or he needed wisdom to be with him. And it's a sort of preliminary way of thinking that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and we know that Jesus was there, and it was a combined effort between Father, Son, and of course the Holy Spirit, who was there in Genesis 1 as well. So the wisdom passage, I think, fits in with that, almost as a sort of another, or not just another person, but part of God's person, if you like. So, oh, it's once your hand's gone up.
Okay, hands up. Yes, I'm not sure who was first.
It was me. Just to say that I thought that it was Christ.
When you're reading Proverbs.
When you said that it's wisdom, I thought that was Christ.
Well, later on, as Paul, I think it says, Paul says, Christ is the wisdom of God. It all fits in. You're right. Good. Is it Betty next or Pat?
Betty.
Yes, I knew that it was about wisdom because you'd said it was about wisdom, but I read it that it was Christ, and it set me off. On, I went on quite on a reverie about the triune spirit of God and the Trinity, and it is mind-blowing in a wonderful way. I mean, it's just I can't expect to get my mind around it because God is far too great for me to understand, really.
And that again is where poetry helps, because it does that. And in fact, what you're doing is you're tying the rest of the Bible together into this. You're not just reading a passage, you're allowing the whole revelation, because you've read the Bible and you know, you believe it all and so on, you will get much more as each bit interacts with other bits. So Pat then, and then we'll move on, I think.
It's in Proverbs, eat, and it's talking about the different creations and things. And then in verse, was it 8? It talks about the sons of men. And to me, that links to me in Genesis 6.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, that's a good moment in which we move on to Genesis 6 and so on. In the remaining half hour today and our final session next time, though that's a hint that next week is the last one I'm doing before our summer break, that we've got still quite a few more bits of Genesis to try and find the weirdness. Now, so we're really picking it up from chapter 6 onwards, perhaps from chapter 6 to 9. We may just have to stop at that point. And I know everybody is going to say, oh, what's all this Nephilim stuff? That's really weird. So I think, given the time that we've got, I will leave that over to next time, but I might say one or two things at the very end. So while you're thinking of odd things within the flood story, let me point one or two things out. Where does this flood story actually begin, given that chapter numbers aren't always helpful? Well, how about chapter 6 and verse 5? Look at chapter 6 and verse 5. I think I've got to share my screen again in case I want to refer to some of this. Now, chapter 6, verse 5. It's a very extreme and really quite horrible statement, really, about the wickedness of man. There it is. And it really lays it on really thick and fast. The wickedness of man was great in the earth. Every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Boy, I don't think you could say it more strongly than that, could you? It's all in here somewhere. Every inclination, yetzer, somewhere there's imagination, I don't know that word, of the thoughts of his heart, there's ra, evil, all the days, you know, so like day after day after day, every single day, every moment of every day, that was all that man could do at that point. And no wonder verse 6, which is probably one of the saddest verses in the whole Bible, the Lord decided, well, he repented. It's almost like at this point it changed his mind, it grieved his heart, and so on. That takes some getting your head around, actually, but it's there to show you how both things have gone. But did you realise that a similar phrase occurs at the end in chapter 8 and verse 21? So if that's the beginning of the story, 6:5. If we go to 8:21, I think it is. We'll see in a minute.
Yes.
Did you realise God said pretty much the same sort of thing? This is after it's all over, and Noah's built an altar. There's a pleasing odour of sacrifice. The Lord says in his heart, okay, I will not do this again. But he still says, for the imagination of man's heart is evil. Oh, here's an interesting change. From his youth. Now, I don't know whether any thoughts on that, but I can't explain anything why suddenly it says from his youth, from his childhood, and so on. But basically, it's telling me that obviously what God has done in the flood and so on hasn't put everything right. The sinful nature of man is still there. But God is not going to destroy everything again in the same way. But I wonder why it says, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth now. Because clearly it's a little repetition of something to show us how the story begins and ends, typical Hebrew storytelling. But it seems a bit different. But I can't say anything more than the fact that it's slightly different. Betty, do you know why it changes to that.
No, I don't know at all. It's just that babies are pretty straightforward. They know what they want. They haven't got any guile.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's only when they begin to get a little bit older.
Yes.
They manipulate you a little bit, you know, and you can see it quite early on. Probably, I would say probably from the age of two, but other people might have different experience. But it's pretty obvious that they're very truthful and very straightforward babies. You know what they want. You're not in any doubt at all.
Yeah. But it's all there waiting to come out later, isn't it?
Yeah. But another thing I thought of with the, and it made me very sad, with saying about the state and the fact that it grieved God's heart. And then, of course, he says it will be as it was in the days of Noah, which is exactly where we are at the moment.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for that. Yeah, someone else had a hand up, did they?
Yes, Lynn.
Yeah, I was just thinking that because we're born into sin, so from birth we're born in a fallen state.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, fine. That's bringing later insights and revelation into that from, say, the New Testament and so on, which is fine. As a sort of filling out of our understanding of it. But I just wonder why he doesn't say evil from his birth or whatever. But there we are. Now, if that's the beginning and end of the whole story, where's the central point? Where's the climax of it? And we go back to chapter 8 and verse 1. And sometimes people explain why it's the centre because they can actually count all the words in Hebrew and say, oh, look, that's the very middle of it. But the story pivots around this phrase, and God remembered Noah. And God remembered Noah. So when you're reading this through, perhaps ready for next time, bear in mind when you get to that verse, you've reached the centre of it. And from this point onwards, like in any typical storytelling, everything is going to come back back down again, if you like. So what's it mean when it says God remembered Noah? It doesn't mean that he had forgotten about him for a long time. You know, he shut them all up in this big box that was floating around. And suddenly one day God woke up and thought, oh, yes, I must remember Noah. Something needs to happen here. Remember is always a very powerful word within Scripture. I guess it's here, Yitzkor. Okay. And it's nothing to do with the memory. God doesn't have a memory in the same way that we do. It's to do with the will, and it's to do with action. So every time you say, and God remembered somebody, it means now was the time for him to act on their behalf. So that occurred with some of the ladies that were barren. Suddenly God remembered, I think Hannah would be an example. And God remembering us means that he is actually, it's a covenant word really, even though a covenant is not yet sort of in place with Noah, but it's how God relates to us. Suddenly he does something. And at this point, the story, as I say, goes back down again. And there's some fascinating features here. Where have we got to? God made a wind to pass over the earth, the Elohim Ruach. Where did we meet that? Well, back in Genesis 1, when the Spirit of God hovered. Okay. There's hints again of the creation story, because what is God going to have to do again? He's going to have to separate as the waters subside. And the waters returning off from off the earth continually, and so on. So this really is almost like a new birth, not a new creation, but a sort of recreation. And there are hints back to Genesis 1 of what God is going to do. And in fact, even you get a reference to light, I think, at one point. Doesn't at some point he opened the window. No, he doesn't mention light, I don't think. But at some point, Noah opens the window. Does it say, and light came in? Well, I made that bit up.
I think you made that up.
I made that bit up, but certainly opens a window. Yes, perhaps I'm pushing that too much. But then we get various creatures coming.
Verse 13, he removes the coverings of the ark. Would that be it?
Well, I think earlier he had opened a window because the birds are coming in and out and so on. Right. But and when you are reading through this, take a note of all the numbers, because
it's verse 6.
Verse 6 is the window, is it? Open the window is made in the ark. That's right. Okay, you've got to imagine that means the light's coming in, right? I mean, they must have been shut up in this thing without the windows being open, because it'd been raining so much. But coming back to the numbers, we all know about the 40 days and so on. But what about the 150 days? There's references to 150 days. And there's also references to 7 days as well. And it acts like, throughout the story, that these numbers build up in the first part of the story and then repeat again in the second part of the story. So if you want a hint as to how to sort of underline one or two things as you're reading through it, you could look for things like, I've just found here, he stayed yet another 7 days. Okay, interesting, use the number 7 here and so on. Within the whole context of 40 days and 150 days. Do you remember how long he was in the ark altogether? It was a long time, wasn't it? Because he went into the ark when he was 600 years on the 17th day of the second month. And then we get a reference to the first day of the first month of his 601st year. And then you get a reference to the 27th day of the second month, and so on. So if you want to, you can work out just how long some of these things happened. While the rains came, well, then the waters had to subside, and they still had to wait another 7 days from time to time. Did a hand go up a moment ago?
Elaine.
Yes, please. In the Genesis 6, verse 5, verse.
Okay.
So I've got the message here and it says about expecting a lifespan of 120 years. And and that's not mentioned, I mean, that's not mentioned at all in the next bit that alludes to, you know, the God being broken, having a broken heart by evil, but.
Okay, so why is it saying 120 years? Explain more what you mean there.
That's what I'm wondering, whether there's, you know, whether it's just something not to take much notice of.
But it's a footnote reference or something, is it? It's a comment, it's not in
the text. It's actually in the text.
Verse 3.
Verse 3 now.
Oh, verse 3, yes.
Verse 3. Okay. No, that's the bit we're not looking at yet. This actually isn't referring to the lifetime of a man. It's referring to the length of time for God deciding that he would make this judgment and to actually the rains coming.
Oh,
it answers the question, how long did Noah have to build this ark? And the answer is 120 years, which is interesting because it means that he was about 480 when he was told this. And the next thing we know about him is he had children. So God had also had to wait for him to have a family. And presumably he needed 3 strapping young lads to help him build this big boat. Okay. I mean, we've got to be realistic about this. It was going to take them an awful long time. And it even says in the New Testament about God waiting patiently for the ark to be built. In other words, he couldn't start the flood too soon. But he's made his decision in chapter 6, verse 3. And so his days will be, is referring to the fact that his spirit will not contend with man forever. And so he's got another 120 years before the flood comes. But having said that, after the flood, lifespans did reduce significantly. And there's probably
because the thing is, sorry, Paul.
Go on.
Well, because the thing is that, you know, in these beginning chapters, you know, in Genesis, so many people seem to live, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And also, even, you know, when we later get to Abraham and Sarah, having a baby at 90, but 90 something.
They've come down a lot from the 300, 600, even 900 that we've had earlier. It's as though God needed people to live longer early on so that they could get on with the multiplying, the population growth and so on. But also, it's speculated, obviously, but it could well be true that everything was much purer and the genetic form of man was purer. They could live longer. They didn't age as quickly and so on. Mm. But obviously, God's behind it all anyway.
Because this seems about the only time in history that there's any sign that man lived that longer than just 100 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are more people, increasingly number of people these days with a lifespan of more than 100.
Yeah.
Say they were some years ago, but
okay.
But never, you know, anywhere near like 500 or 600.
It is one of the weirdnesses of this story, but other creation stories have people living longer still, apparently, particularly the important people, the sort of main characters in these epics. They will live for thousands of years within these stories.
One of the key theories about the long years then that then reduced was because at that time they weren't exposed to the ultraviolet radiation.
Yeah.
And so that didn't corrupt the DNA.
Yeah. I'm sure there's something in all that, whatever it was. It's worth pointing out that, and I think I've said this before, that we're dealing with a lot of firsts here. The first human to be born, the first to die, and all the rest of these are the firsts. This was the first time that it actually rained, as in water falling from the sky. Mm-hmm. God has separated it, ready for this to happen. But previously, the earth had been watered by springs and by, I think, mist, it says, but nothing actually falling from the sky. And that's almost like that was being held there, ready for it to come in judgment, because part of it would be the scariness of actually suddenly seeing this, whatever it was like, collapsing down on Earth. Nowadays, when it rains for us, we just think, oh, it's another wet day. But you just imagine it's the first time you've seen water come down like that and not stop and just wonder what's going to happen. And of course, all the springs of the great deep burst forth as well as the floodgates of the heavens opening, and it went on for day and day and day, 40 days altogether. The interesting question, of course, is where did all the water eventually go? Now, I'm assuming some of it went back up into the atmosphere, ready to be later rain, but a lot of it would have gone back into the earth. and I can't remember this detail now, but there is enough capacity inside the earth to hold the amount of water that could well have come down in this flood. But that's very vague of me because I haven't read that recently enough to know totally what I'm talking about.
Mary has a hand up. Mary? You need to unmute yourself, Mary.
That's it. I just would like to make a comment because I've got a comment in my Bible about the first four verses of chapter 6 with the Nephilim. And
can we leave that for next time now, please?
All right.
Really? Okay. I don't mind you making the comment, but I might then just say, okay, fine, for now. But go on, I'll hear your comment, but I'm not necessarily in the last 10 minutes going to launch into all that. We will do it next time.
Right, fine.
But make your comment. I don't want to be...
Oh, make the comment. I've got a wee note in my Bible and it said, this was a satanic attempt to nullify Genesis 3:15.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure that will come in useful when we look at it next time. I'll give you another week to work through what you think that might be going on in those particular verses. but it is important. I'll say now, remember from the beginning, God separated. And one thing that he did was to separate man from the animals. And we came across that in Genesis 3, the importance of recognizing that difference between the human animal, if you like, and the other beasts of the field. So whatever God has created after its kind, God intends to stay within that particular kind. And there's not to be sort of, shall we say, cross-fertilization. But that's another little teaser for next time. Meanwhile, in the in the flood story, as I said, we've spotted how it sort of begins with this inclination of the thoughts of his heart was evil. It ends with the same sort of thing, that even though God has wiped the earth clean and is starting again, it hasn't changed the nature of man. But we do now get a covenant. And God is going to make a covenant with Noah. And another feature that you recognize and look for in Hebrew stories is word repetition. And if when you get to, say, verse 8, 9, and so on, if you want to underline, see how many times the word covenant appears from verse 9 to verse 17. I mean, what I'm really saying is, let's read verses 8 to 17, and as you do that, just spot the word repetition. Not just covenant, but there's a lot of them. So
chapter 9.
We're now chapter 9. When
from verse where?
Well, if you start from verse 8, that's when God starts to speak about his covenant, his berit. Okay, it's the first use of this word covenant. Oh, look, I've got the word hineni again. And I behold. and I behold, I establish my covenant. But read from there to verse 17 and see if just from the word repetition, you get a real feel for what is being said here.
Sorry, are we doing this now, Paul, or did you mean for next week?
No, now.
Oh, sorry, okay.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to read these verses and
it's six times.
Yeah. Go on, yeah.
Well, it's mentioned six times, this covenant. Is that representing the 6 days of creation?
Oh, well, okay, I wasn't trying to push it that far. I was just saying that when God wants us to really get hold of something, he will repeat and he will use the word. And in certain places, did you notice any other words that seem to come out quite a bit? I think yes, in fact, you might find there's seven uses of the word covenant, actually. Does anyone get seven?
Well, yeah, there's seven.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not trying to make it a competition of who can count, but I think the word covenant does occur seven times. There's another word that occurs seven times, I think.
Ooh.
And other words that perhaps rather unusually, you think, why is that being repeated a lot? How about the word cloud that seems to come in quite a bit? How many clouds can you read? You see in the next verse 14, it's there twice. It does seem to be rather unnecessary repetition. But what is God saying through this? And another repeated word is back to earth, aretz. Aretz, the earth. And here we are again with the bow, where is it? I think I've just done 14. The bow shall be in the cloud. And there's another use of covenant and earth and so on. And upon the earth. So, in fact, it's almost, if we, you and I were writing this or someone was editing it, they'd get the pencil out and say, don't keep saying cloud, don't keep saying this and so on. You're overdoing it. But that's what happens here. And in fact, there is no word rainbow. Sorry to disappoint you. It is just bow. And it means arch. So it's the shape of it that counts. So we call it a rainbow, which is fair enough. But there's no Hebrew word for rainbow. It just means an arch. They would understand that from literally a bow and arrows type bow. It would look like an archer about to fire something up with his bow. So they would understand well, eventually they would understand it in those terms, but it's the shape of it, the arch shape. A couple of hands up.
Jeremy?
Thank you. We're saying, in connection with the bow, in my mind, it's been the refractive index of light that settled it for me that there wasn't rain before. But I'm wondering how safe that is as I sort of go back and review everything I've always thought. Mm-hmm. How do we know that it didn't rain, especially if it's only the shape?
Sorry, I'm missing the connection between the shape and the rain.
Well, the rainbow, I had thought, showed that it was something new because it was making the covenant. My logic may be jumping a bit far, but it was because of the refractive index of light that I was thinking this is showing that it hasn't rained in the past. I'm just wondering, is there some other way of anchoring the idea that it's never rained before?
No, it's just the way I read it, that it makes the whole thing much more dramatic. And it was the floodgates of the heaven opening. And it also says that back in chapter 2, the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth. But it does talk about the springs of the earth. It was watered by springs and by mist somewhere. Yeah. Now, I know a long time has gone by since chapter 2, in the sense that had been over all those years, it only happened like that. But I'm speculating a bit further on that. But I do think that when it came down in the flood, that's why there was such a change to the whole climate. And in fact, you can probably tell that if scientists are honest enough and actually want to believe in the flood. You can see the effect on the earth of this huge amount of water suddenly coming down. So if it did rain before, it might have been a bit of a drizzle or something, but it won't have been anything as dramatic as this. I think the whole ecosystem changed, basically. But I must admit, I'm a bit out of my depth in some of these statements. But
well, Mary's comment at the beginning, I've been thinking of throughout in terms of that day too. Because it seems to be the bit of creation that God completely undid. And he didn't call it good at the beginning.
That's where he separated the waters.
Yeah.
Though he knew they would have to use this, but he wasn't as happy with that bit.
It's something, isn't there?
Yes. That's a good yeshiva type point. Was anybody else with a hand up?
Yes, Mary.
I just want to share an experience I had. I was coming back from Israel and we were flying, coming down to in Britain. And there was not a rainbow, but it was like a hoop. Not a hoop, not even a hoop. It would be like a rainbow, but the other way around. And I could distinctly see it. And the plane flew through this upside down rainbow, if you like. It was an experience which I'll never forget. But maybe somebody can explain it to me.
Ooh. I can't, but
it was an upside down rainbow, and the plane flew through it. It was incredible.
Thank you. Any other comments or thoughts? I'll just add something I said a long time back, that when it says that Noah had three sons or became the father of Shem, Ham and Japheth, that does not mean that was their birth order. That does not mean that Shem was the oldest and so on. We saw this before with Abraham and Nahor and Haran. The first mention is the one that's going to be the most important. So they're always, I think they're always in the order of Shem, Ham and Japheth. But Ham is actually the youngest and Japheth is probably the oldest. So that doesn't mean they're in birth order, but Shem is going to be the most important. And I was trying to find something else. The order in which they went into the ark. Oh, we haven't talked about the animals, of course. we may do in a minute. Let's have the comment from Rosalind while I try and work out what I'm meant to be saying next.
Yeah, just a quick one. It was just, I wondered whether you'd asked a question about why the Lord in the beginning had said that all was good, and then he, I think the word was repented, or he was saddened by man's sinfulness. Did you pose a question there, or am I getting that wrong?
No, I didn't particularly pose a question. It just showed the consequences of the fall and made a big difference.
Yes.
And we're going to see how the consequences of the early part of chapter really made the big difference. Mm.
So okay, thanks. Yeah, thanks.
This is just an interesting little snippet, if I found it properly. The order in which they went into the ark was Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. This is in chapter 7 and verse 7. Okay, and that's because God had said to, this is chapter 6, and this might get a bit confusing. Chapter 6 and verse 18, God has said, you will enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives. So it's not women and children first as such, it's Noah and sons, and then the women later. I mean, there's not a lot of time difference, I'm making that point. But it's there in chapter 7, verse 7. Again, Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. Okay? Now look at the order in which they are meant to come out of the ark. This is in chapter 8 and verse 15. What do you notice?
The women come first.
Well, his wife is allowed to come out before the sons. Yeah?
Yeah.
There's a slight difference. I'm not going to make a huge point about this. I just find it interesting. But then that's what God said. Come out, you, your wife, your sons and their wives. And then when they did come out in verse 18, what do you notice? Noah came out first and then
sons.
The sons again. So Noah did actually obey God in that, if that was meant to be the case. He didn't come out hand in hand with his wife. He still let his sons come out first. But maybe there's no real point to the order. Maybe it doesn't matter too much. I'll leave that one with you as we've come to the end, really. So keep looking from verse 6 onwards for next time. We will look at the Nephilim. We might find some more interesting details about the flood story. I say we haven't really looked at the animals, but this is not a Sunday school story. This is not, you know, the animals went in two by two. It's much more powerful and dramatic than that. And you might find some other interesting things about the flood story, or weird things. And I think we covered before, but I might mention again, the strange event at the end of chapter 9 about Ham and what happened there. And then there's only the Tower of Babel, which we might also managed to squeeze in, but the chances are you'll probably want to spend a lot of time asking about the Nephilim and what's going on there. So will that do for today? Shall we?
Yes, sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I by the time I find the hands, the meeting will probably be over. Can you just remind me, is it chapter 9, verse 6 onwards that we're reading, or something else?
Well.
Just remind me what we meant to read.
Do you mean for next time?
Yes, please.
Oh, well, we're starting at chapter 6.
Oh.
The bit of chapter 6 that we didn't actually consider, because I didn't want to try and do it in half an hour.
And then as far as...
Well, you can just keep reading the whole flood story again and see. I've dipped into it in bits and pieces. I've given you a sort of shape to it, to the point where God remembers Noah, and then everything comes back again and you get the covenant. But there's lots of other details that you might find. So basically, it's the whole of chapters 6, 7, 8 and 9, if you want.
Thank you very much.
But we need to look at the various ideas about the... strange goings on in the opening of chapter 6. Right, let's get rid of all that. Any final thoughts or comments? So,
thank you very much.
Okay, then. Well,
did you say you're having this was the last one?
No, next week is the last one.
Next week's the last one.
Okay, then I'm having August off. Steve will say something next week about. What might be happening in August, and then I'm coming back on September the 10th.
Okay, I'll stop the recording.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Thank you.